So classically, in an outright deflationary environment, one of the best places to be is in long-term government bonds, treasury bonds, right? Even zero coupon bonds as being the longest duration kind of bond you can buy.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart here at the end of the week with one of the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, John Lodra. New Harbor Financial is one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion. Regular viewers are very familiar with John. He joins me every week along with his partner, Mike Preston, who's actually traveling today. So John's going to go solo. John, thanks so much for joining.
Hey, thank you for having me again, Adam. Always great to be with you every week. And no shortage of things to cover and talk about.
No, in this week, we're going to talk about the recently released inflation data. So CPI headline inflation came down pretty materially, came in at 3.0%. It's actually even a little bit lower than what expectations were. Now, I don't think this was a huge shock to people. I think we did expect inflation was going to come down pretty dramatically on a year-over-year basis. So, you know, in one sense, you can look at this and say, hey, good on you, Jerome Powell. You know, you're making progress here fighting inflation. 3% is now getting within spitting distance of the Fed's target of 2%. But the Fed's work really may not be done yet. And maybe we can, A, just talk about your reaction to the data, but then we can also talk about the base effects and how inflation may, CPI at least, may actually tick up over the coming months here.
Yeah, Adam. So this week's report did come out. It was very highly anticipated, as every CPI report has been, because it really gets to the question of the Fed's rate hiking campaign that started a little over a year ago, and how much further they will likely hike rates to try to keep inflation in check. Something that they originally felt was going to be transitory and then became very entrenched. So there was plenty of guesses out there and estimates of where things would come in. But frankly, the market or the leanings were it was going to come in softer than expected. And that's exactly what happened. Not dramatically so, but soft enough that it was below expectations. So for example, the month over month core CPI came in at 0.2% month over month increase. And annualized closer to 3%, right? Which is dramatic reduction from where we were a year ago when this time last year, headline inflation was at 9.1% year over year. So there's been a dramatic drop in that. But that very thing is why we think the readings going forward are not likely to decelerate at the same pace. Not in fact, I'd like to share a chart. A Bank of America chart was put out that basically looks at, you know, scenarios of future inflation paths over the next year or so, and it really gets to this concept of base effects. So let me share my screen here just to kind of get it in living color. Can you see that slide? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So basically, you see here, you know, a year ago we were at 9.1%. Last month we were at 4. You know, as of this week, we know what the June reading was, and it was 0.3% with a 0.2% month over month. But basically, the gist of this chart is that unless month over month CPI stays at less than 0.2%, which is what this month's reading was, we're essentially going to see an increase in inflation readings. Just simply by virtue of the fact that the base effects, the base comparison numbers that we're starting to compare year over year, are far lower than they were when 9.1% was the base number. So depending on the path of you know, month over month growth here, you can see we could have anywhere from 2.5% to 6% if that picks back up. So by no means, I don't think it'd be way premature, and the Fed's been pretty communicative about this, that there's still a lot of work likely to be done, and especially if you get into some of the more entrenched sticky parts of CPI that really is what the Fed's more concerned about. Those are still at pretty high levels. Yes, in some cases, those levels hadn't been seen since the 80s. Still work to be done. And the next chart, basically, I think we'll get to this is what the inflation profile looked like in the 70s. this is the boogeyman that the Fed is trying to avoid. You know, we had three separate and increasingly concerning bouts with inflation, got up to about 14%, I think, in the early 80s. That's the boogeyman that the Fed is trying to not revisit, because that was devastating to consumers, to the economy, and ultimately the stock market. The 1982 generational low in the stock market brought stocks to less than a quarter of their valuations today. So that's obviously something that the Fed wants to try to avoid repeating. And therefore, you know, we think basically the fight is still very much alive in terms of by no means do. Is it likely the Fed will start reducing rates? And it's still quite on the table whether they'll raise rates in the upcoming meetings, July being the most near one. And that's kind of the big take. I'm happy to talk about some of the market reaction, but I'll pause there and just kind of we can carry the conversation from there.
Sure, we'll get to the market reaction in a second. But when you showed that chart of the increasing peaks in CPI, that is the Fed chair who presided over the majority of those periods was a guy named Arthur Burns. And when you hear that Jerome Powell doesn't want to go down in history as another Arthur Burns, that's exactly what he's trying to avoid, right? He's trying to avoid this resurgence of inflation, which is why he continues to talk tough, has set the market expectations. He's going to continue resume hiking again here. You mentioned that, so very important that we all keep the base effects in mind, right? I think the vast majority of people are just watching the trajectory and saying, great, the inflation fight's over and inflation's just going to get lower from here. The math of the base effect says, hey, not so fast. So, curious, proactive, data-driven folks like the folks who watch this channel have a little bit of advantage knowing what's likely to be coming here, which is going to be a surprise for the majority as CPI most likely is going to tick back up from here. And key components of it are remaining sticky. Like you said, John, services really haven't come down that much. Services is still pretty sticky. What is interesting to note is that the rent component of CPI, which is the biggest component in there, is looking like it peaked a few months back. It's just beginning to come off now. We've talked for a long time about how that's a lagging indicator. But if that starts catching up to what we're seeing more in the real-time data with rents and what's happening in the housing market, and in a little bit, John, we'll talk about the video that we just released on this channel the other day with housing analyst Nick Jurley, that actually could, materially start beginning to bring CPI down. So there's going to be some cross currents going on here, which is really going to be interesting to see. There's one chart that I want to show real quickly, John. So let me try to see if I can share my screen here. You able to see this chart?
Yeah, I sure can. Yep.
Okay. So this is a chart of M2, which is the red line here, which is money supply. This is the change in money supply. And as you can see, it skyrocketed dramatically during the pandemic as we had all the extraordinary stimulus programs released. But it's now declined quite aggressively. The change in M2 is now negative. And if we could extend this chart back, 50 plus years, this may be the only negative reading we would see in M2. It's not a metric that goes negative or has gone negative much in its existence. So what this shows, though, is that all of the inflation indicators, CPI, PPE, PCE, they're pretty tightly correlated with the changes in those indices are tightly correlated with changes in M2. And they M2 leads the others by about 16 months, mm-hmm. right? So if you look at this chart and you say, okay, well, if that correlation is going to continue going forward, then this actually makes a pretty, direct case for, inflation being tamed in about a year and a half and actually perhaps being in deflation, no longer being in disinflation, but outright deflation in about a year and a half. So we'll see what's going to happen from here. But, we have a number of people on this channel, people like Lacey Hunt, people like Stephanie Pomboy, who have been warning that, yes, it's important that the Fed get inflation under control, But that really the bigger issue here is going to be deflation. That's what was kind of in the driver's seat before the pandemic hit. It's going to shift back to being in the driver's seat once inflation gets below a certain level. So like you said, John, we may have some cross currents over the next couple of months or quarter or two as base effects and, you know, other sort of sticky elements fight with declining rents and some of the other things that are going on. But it looks like the overarching trajectory here, particularly as shown by that chart, you know, very well may be shifting towards deflation in a way that many folks aren't expecting right now.
Yeah, Adam, that absolutely is a possible scenario. We've talked a lot about the lag effects on many of these macroeconomic factors in the economy, the interest rates and things like that. As you know, there have been progression of indicators that signal a more likely period of recession. Employment has been one of the brightest spots, against that case. But even there, we're starting to see some tiring. I will note, I think in today's report, there was a tick up in some of the wages. I didn't get in deep enough to explore, what segment that was in. But that's, the Fed has talked about needing to cool the labor market, and that's certainly one thing that's not cooled off. I will note that there's been pretty dramatic slowdown in the consumer behavior. Redfin, for example, just reported, I think, the first decline in retail sales going back to 2008. I think if you exclude the period of COVID in 2020. So that's pretty dramatic. It's not often that you see a decline like that. That's showing a consumer that is pulling in their horns. You look at consumer debt and things like revolving debt for student loans and cars. That has definitely been trailing off here as interest rates and pressures on the consumer have taken their hold. That's coincident also with a pretty dramatic spend down in surplus savings coming out of the COVID stimulus and whatnot. So yeah, a lot of factors do lean towards a possible economic slowdown joining in this and maybe exacerbating the rate of deceleration, but probably again to the chart you just shared, we're probably talking about several months out before that battle can be claimed victory because of the lag effects.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's going to be really interesting to be monitoring this. And again, for the viewers here to keep in mind is think of this theme as cross currents here, right? You're going to have some of these inflationary ones still coming in while the deflationary ones are maybe beginning to surge. And then over time, one of those two will win out, but it's probably going to be both an interesting time, but maybe a fairly deceptive time where a lot of people might take the wrong conclusion from the signals. So we want to make sure that you're keeping your sort of eyes on the prize here and where the puck is going. You mentioned a couple of things I just want to dig into real briefly. One, because CPI has now come down as low as it is, that has finally broken an important streak around wages. Wages actually had their first month of year-over-year positive growth in 27 months. So we've been talking, for a long time on this program, over 2 years, that consumers have been falling further and further behind, because even though nominally wages have been going up post-pandemic, it hasn't been keeping up with inflation. And so real wages have actually been negative. This is the first month that they're actually slightly getting ahead on wages. We'll see if that trend continues. We hope it does, because the consumer does need some real help here, as you mentioned there, John. Two articles that came out this week. One was more sort of anecdotal, but it was showing, it was data-driven. It was showing that attendance at major theme parks like Disney are down pretty substantially. Some photos of Disney here in the height of summer where it should be at its most packed, and kind of looks like a ghost town, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yep. Yeah. And on the wages, that's great for workers, of course, right? Hopefully that trend continues, or at least doesn't degrade again. But what's good for workers is almost categorically bad for corporate America insofar as profit margins. And that's one of the big anomalies that's been present in the stock market for quite a number of years now, actually. Just the record elevated profit margins, no small part funded by basically a transfer of fiscal stimulus on the government side into the pockets of corporations and consumers, who then put it into the pockets of corporations. So that, you know, here we are, very rich valuations in the stock market, and at a time where corporate profit margins have rarely, if ever, been as sustainedly wide as they are, and almost certainly in one of the most reliably mean reverting series in economics, those profit margins will narrow, and that obviously can only add to the headwinds of further rises of a very elevated stock market broadly.
Yeah, and just on that point, to help folks understand, so even though the inflation rate is coming down, you know, it prices are still increasing just at a slower rate, right? So the input costs that corporations are having to deal with, yes, the increase in those input costs is slowing, but they're still rising, right? So you combine that with the largely shutting off of the fiscal stimulus spigot that was going directly to households, right? That pig in the python that we talk about, the remaining pig in the python is getting less and less and less. Yes, there is some fiscal stimulus going on, but it's really concentrated, right? It's concentrated in infrastructure spending right now and construction. Corporations are seeing, you know, still rises in their inputs. And now if the rising wage costs are biting in, you know, that does just continue to decrease corporate profits, as you were talking about. And yeah, we'll, you know, probably not find too many people who are going to shed a tear for corporations that are going to have to start having to live in a world of not record profits. But what's interesting is we could be cheering this rise in real wages, but potentially it could presage increased layoffs as corporations are increasingly forced to tighten their belt. I don't know. We'll see what happens from here, but that's just something to keep an eye on. One other thing I want to mention too in the data was another article that talked about how consumers are actually spending less year over year on food and consumer staples. And what's important about this is it's less on a unit volume basis, right? When you look at it at a dollar volume basis, it's still kind of deceptive because prices have been going up so much over the past couple of years. But if you just look at actual units, you know, the number of things that consumers are actually buying, it's going down. And it's another sign that the consumer household is getting increasingly pinched. So again, you know, headlines are still focused on inflation, but, you know, we're seeing signs here that as the consumer struggles, you know, this is a consumer-driven economy, 70% of GDP is consumer spending. You know, we go back to that M2 chart, maybe we're beginning to see sort of early signs of where things are going. And the reason why I want to just sort of stick on this deflationary theme for a moment, John, and I do want to talk in a minute about how the market's responding to these lower inflation readings. I want to just ask you the general question, like if it looks eventually like deflation is indeed going to win out, how does one invest for a future of deflation?
Yeah, well, deflation, or, you know, obviously deflation is one thing, but even just deceleration of inflation or
disinflation,
right? So those are two different things. So classically, in an outright deflationary environment, one of the best places to be is in long-term government bonds, treasury bonds, right? Even zero coupon bonds as being the longest duration kind of bond you can buy. And the reason for that is, you know, economic activity collapses, prices collapse, and yields ultimately collapse. And that's classically one of the best place to be in a classic deflationary environment. I think we're way too early to call that as the scenario du jour here. But in a decelerating inflation, you know, where inflation's still there, but decelerating or moderating, some of the areas that will likely do well are, frankly, some of the areas that have been challenged in recent months. Things like commodities, precious metals and precious metal mining stocks, emerging markets. You know, not only are they far better valued and demographically situated than developed markets like the U.S., but you know, they're denominated in local currencies and not in U.S. dollar. One of the big early reactions to the CPI numbers this week was a real collapse in the dollar. Dollar broke down through some really heavy support levels and is trading, you know, a little over 100 on the DXY index. That's a pretty big move down in a single day. You know, this is from highs back in, I guess it was September of last year of almost 115. So that the dollar has pulled back pretty dramatically over the last several months. But this initial reaction to the CPI print is notable. And that's caused things like precious metals to shoot higher. I think the move in gold mining stocks was at least the time of the initial reaction was four times as high on the upside as for example, the S&P 500. So stocks across the board generally rallied, but some of these and emerging market stocks moved quite a bit more noticeably to the upside because of some of these decelerations in potential inflation and not a pivot by the Fed, but just a slowdown or an eventual light at the end of the tunnel of likely further near term increases. Anyways, that's enough to I think, and we're seeing it early in the reaction to put a bid under some of these areas that have struggled as inflation has been persistently problematic and has caused the Fed to time after time come out with more hawkish kind of commentary and actions.
Okay. And is it sort of safe to assume here too that the market, which has been so pivot oriented for past year, is it too simplistic just to think that the investment mindset right now is lower inflation means Fed going to stop hiking soon, and it just means the date of a Fed policy reversal at some point in time is now sooner than we were thinking it was a month ago?
Yeah, it's really too early, I think, to say, Adam. I think it's obviously put a little bit more of a dovish tilt on the table here. But to those charts I shared early on, it'd be way premature if history's any guide to declare, the inflation boogeyman as being slain. Again, just due to data constructs and the base effects, but also some of these persistently sticky things. And 1 month doesn't create a trend, certainly not in these kind of very complex economic machinations that have very complex factors that drive them.
Yeah, agreed. Great reminder. I asked that question because, again, I want to reemphasize this period of cross currents that we're likely going to head into here, where the market has just been seeming to want to declare victory at every point it can that, now is when the Fed's going to pivot, right? And I'm sure part of today is the market's just taking that data and saying, okay, great, this is a pivot-friendly development, right? But it might get disappointed as CPI starts ticking up again, as you warned us with those charts.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what the talking heads, the Fed heads, I think there's several on the calendar for speaking engagements. I think the job owning will be interesting to watch and the market reaction to that.
Okay. Well, next time,
don't matter.
Next time you and Mike are back on the channel, you can decode all those Fed utterances for us. Let's talk about gold just for a second. Because you just mentioned some very short-term developments that are going on following the announcement of this new CPI data. There's also been some, I would say some more cyclical positive developments for gold. One just came out that I was reading about in the Financial Times the other day, is that we've just had record volume buying by sovereign nations and central banks in terms of buying bullion. We just saw, I think, the highest buying, I think, in 11 years. I think we're actually now at a record level here. Clearly, the central banks and countries are, there's something that's spurring that, right? And it's either a belief that it's a superior store of value, and it's something that nations need to be holding for national sovereignty and monetary soundness reasons, or perhaps something else. And what's interesting is they are largely doing this by just buying bullion, right? They're buying physical bullion. They're not buying ETFs. They're not buying derivatives. They're buying the actual hard physical stuff and storing it. And tied to that is how they're storing it. An increasing number of these countries are actually repatriating their gold. So like the stores in England, the bullion stores there in England are actually seeing drawdowns as a lot of countries around the world, particularly in Europe, are saying, hey, I actually want to be storing my gold now, not with you, but inside our own borders. So, would love to get any sort of general feedback you have on that. But, you know, it's sort of like when you always got to look at what they do versus what they say. You know, countries are quick, central bankers are quick to tell you that gold, you know, is a relic of the past. It's not something that's very interesting. Yet on the other hand, you know, they're buying it at record amounts, like I just said. And also sort of like, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Like, hey, if nations are doing this, probably something that the average individual might want to consider having a little bit of personal exposure to as well. So love to get your thought to those developments.
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that central banks have for decades, centuries even probably, looked to bullion as a reserve pillar in their own stocks of reserves is says everything, and the record amount of buying and the actions to repatriate it into one's own control, if you will, rather than relying on the friendliness of international relations to be there when if the callback of that bullion is desired. That speaks volumes. Think about the last decade and what has happened. Basically, like no time ever before, probably, there was coordinated action on the part of the central banks of the world to basically engage in quantitative easing and driving interest rates lower, monetizing debt, this and that. And now that's kind of being reversed through rate increases. And as coordinated as that all was over the last decade across developed countries, we're not seeing that same coordination now. There's almost like every man and country for oneself now. So yeah, there's trillions, you know, way more debt in the system. Multiples of debt to GDP across almost every country is way higher than it was prior or post the great financial crisis. Remember that much of this debt was issued at rock bottom interest rates. At one point, 20 or 30 trillion of global sovereign debt was issued at negative interest rates. And here we are without that situation. And this debt's got to come due. It can't just evaporate, right? It's got to be repaid or deflated, or, you know, inflated away or whatever. And that's, you know, that speaks to real stress in the system that I think the actions of the central bank speak to exactly what their concern is, that there could be massive defaults or massive inflation just to carry that debt load. And just like it's a sound thing for central banks, we absolutely think it's a sound thing for individuals. And we kind of think of gold in two ways, as an insurance policy. And that's where the physical bullion piece comes in. You know, we're in favor of folks having a modest but, you know, materially amount of physical bullion as kind of that insurance policy against some of these calamities in the monetary and financial system that could rear their heads. And then secondarily, of course, we see it as an investment. And that's why we like the gold mining stocks as investments. They're, if you just forget what they do for a moment, their cash flow profiles are very strong. Their margins are very strong. The fundamentals from a supply-demand perspective are very supportive, tailwind for, and they're really undervalued relative to where even gold prices are today. So absolutely, we think it's a sound thing for, you know, 5 to 10% of one's total financial worth. We think it's very prudent to think about having some physical metals, preferably out of the system, vaulted locally or safely somewhere else, or somewhere out of the system that's just like the central banks, within, quote unquote, within reach, outside of someone else's control. So yeah, I think really interesting trends there, and it's not just a mirage. It's really happening, and I think individuals should take a cue on that.
All right. Well, very well summarized there, John. I do want to make a quick correction too. So we've had an 11-year high in demand for gold, global demand for gold, that is being driven by record high central bank buying. So that's how those numbers shake out there. All right. So, there's owning the physical bullion itself. And then there's a whole host of other ways to hold gold. And actually, folks, if you're not entirely certain when to be buying physical gold versus perhaps an ETF, which is more sort of trades like a stock, but is tied to the price of gold, versus owning miners and figuring out what type of miners to hold. If you're not familiar with all of that, we have a very easy primer that walks through all that for folks. If you want to get your hands on that, just go to wealthion.com/how-to-buy. You can download it there for free. Sort of at a very simple level, if you want to own gold for the security and safety of it and sort of the crisis insurance, you definitely want to be on the side of the spectrum where you're buying the physical asset itself. That's something that a good financial advisor like John and his team there at New Harbor can direct you towards, but certainly one that we've had a lot of familiarity with on this program. And full disclosure, Wealthion shares investors with this company. The Hard Assets Alliance is a place where you can buy gold in physical form, have it stored in your name, and then you can have it stored in a Brinks vault or equivalent type of vault. Anywhere you like around the world, you can diversify your currency risk by having your gold stored in Zurich or Singapore or other locations around the world. Or if you want to be like a lot of increasing nations right now and have it stored within your own home country, they also offer a number of different storage solutions within the U.S. But if you're interested in learning about that solution, just go to wealthion.com/HAA. I think there's a free storage offer that they're offering through folks that come in through that URL too. So go check that out if that's of interest to you. But if you're interested in basically, like, let's say you've got your foundational position in physical bullion and you're looking to get exposure to, okay, you know, I think the price of precious metals is going to go higher for many of the reasons that John just elaborated there. The precious metals mining stocks can be a very good way to play that because they are quote unquote leveraged to the price of gold. John, do you just want to take 30 seconds for the folks that aren't familiar with that to explain the opportunity that you guys see right now in the precious metals mining space?
Yeah, it's quite simple. From a fundamental valuation standpoint, they've rarely been this compelling as a multiple of the price of metal, but also their profiles of just their corporate balance sheets and financial profiles. You know, an industry that traditionally has been very sloppy, to be candid. The gold mining industry is notoriously over many decades had periods of overbuilding, just reckless, you know, raising a debt and you know, investing in non-productive mines and things like that. They've been forced to clean up their act over the last decade or so, half a decade anyways. So their debt profiles are actually quite manageable. In fact, you know, if you look at a broad swath of corporate America, they almost are a poster child for cleaning up their act. Their free cash flow margins are quite attractive, you know, good quality mining stocks. So they have an all-in average cost of production in the high hundreds to low thousands. And here we are with gold at, as we speak right now, 1960. There's plenty of you know, margin there, even to allow for, you know, input cost fluctuations on, for example, energy costs on the inside. But, you know, even at current prices, they're attractive and could see multiple expansion. But if the price of gold does rise, and we think, a breakout to, you know, above 2000 to 2500 is almost a base case scenario, in our opinion. Typically what happens, because many of the costs associated with a gold mining operation are fixed, you know, just the simple maintenance of a plant, a mine. Each dollar of increase in the price of gold will flow disproportionately to the bottom line in terms of profit margin. So when we talk about gold mining stocks being a levered way to play an increase in the price of gold, we're not talking about leverage in the sense of like financial leverage, like loading on debt, which is a bad thing when prices are a little dodgy. We're talking about operating leverage, which is a construct of basic corporate finance. You know, companies that have high operating leverage means, top line of revenue, for example, because of the price of the commodity increasing that they sell, flows very, very in a magnified way to the bottom line, and the profit margins and the justifiable multiples to be paid for those are can rise many fold times the price of the commodity increase.
Okay. All right. So is it safe to say there's sort of two things going on here? There's first kind of like an ugly duckling effect where the industry, you know, decade ago, not very well run at all, developed a deservedly negative reputation in terms of a place where, you know, capital wasn't treated very well, companies were poorly run, that type of thing. So it's been forced to clean up its act. And now all of a sudden, it's no longer this ugly duckling. You know, these companies are now good looking swans. And then the second trend is the world is waking up to the fact that swans are really great. And so you've got these, you know, companies that are very well capitalized, kicking off lots of great cash flow right at a time where the world is beginning to say, you know what, I think gold's actually a really important asset that we should be holding more of than we've held in the past. So they're kind of in the right state at the right time.
Yeah, all that, Adam, and frankly, the sentiment's been really bad in gold. You know, a lot of the factors that we talked about that seem to be maybe up until today's CPI print some stiff headwinds, maybe now starting to, you know, turn into some tailwinds, or at least not headwinds. You know, rising real interest rates. If the Fed is in fact getting towards the end of their rate campaign, forget about even a pivot downwards, but just the lack of further, you know, the real interest rates have shot up pretty dramatically, you know, the interest rate after inflation. And that is traditionally a very negative for gold. You know, rising real interest rates it has been a negative short-term factor for gold. We could see that absolutely become a tailwind rather than a headwind. The dollar decline, you know, kind of weakness. I'm not talking about dollar collapse. I'm just talking about a retreat in the dollar relative to other currencies. And certainly if the Fed is going to slow down or pause their rate campaigns, I think we should see more dollar retreat here. Again, not a collapse, but a retreat relative to where it's been. So all these things and just a shift in sentiment, we think could be a dramatic, boost higher for this space.
Okay. And just to fully connect the dot for folks, dollar weakness tends to be correlated with positive performance for gold. All right. So last topic I want to talk with you about here is we had this recent interview on this channel this week with housing analyst Nick Jurley, who, you know, Nick always brings a ton of data, which is why I really enjoy talking to him. And, you know, his conclusion remains that the housing market has a correction ahead of it. I think he said probably on the order of magnitude of around 15, maybe 20% nationwide by the time this is all over. And in certain markets, maybe as much as a 35% drop. And, you know, we talked about why this correction has been taking so long in terms of prices to come down. But clearly, housing values seem to have peaked. And, you know, nationally, the price decline so far has been very mild, like around 1% so far, which, of course, is causing a lot of people to question, hey, is this even really going to happen? But if you look at certain markets, especially the ones that were the hottest, you know, over the past 5+ years, the Austins, the Boises, et cetera, those are down double digits even right now, price decline wise, with the momentum still heading downward from here. So, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on your reaction to that video for two reasons, John. One, you know, just in general from a macro standpoint, if Nick is correct and we do end up having a housing price trajectory like he thinks we're going to have, what's that going to do to the economy, and what are the knock-on effects of that are going to be? And then secondly, you know, you as a financial advisor, you deal with people all the time and their money. And for a lot of people, their home is one of their biggest assets. And for many people, it's their biggest asset. So curious if you've got any perspective to add around that too, just in terms of either concerns, worries you're already beginning to hear from your customers, or just things that you would advise the average person keep in mind around housing if we are going through a housing price correction.
Yeah, Adam. First of all, Nick Jurley's talk with you was fabulous. I really enjoy his data supported perspectives, and man, really, really, really spot on, I think, in terms of the pulse of the real estate market. It is a huge issue for our clients, for the economy, and it goes far wider than the stock markets and bond markets and commodity markets that we invest in and manage client assets in every day. You could say the housing market touches a much broader slice of the population than broader financial markets, because it does. Everybody needs a place to live and afford a place to live. I've got two sons in their early to mid 20s. One's out of college, one's about to graduate. And, you know, rents are have been really high, but they're glad to see some moderation, like Nick talked about. You know, that's on their minds. That's on their minds and the minds of many of our clients. That's probably one of the most frequent non-investment things, non-financial market things we talk to clients about, the whole real estate thing. We got folks that are in the phase of life where maybe they want to downsize or relocate to a different state in retirement, whether it's to, you know, get a lower cost of living or weather related or whatever. It's huge. And I think Nick hit the nail on the head in terms of describing the real estate housing market as frozen, right? It has been frozen in the sense that so many people that might otherwise want to sell haven't, because they don't want to, you know, trade one home for an equally overvalued home elsewhere and you know, step into a much higher mortgage rate than they currently have. Or maybe they don't have a mortgage, but they have to finance for other reasons and they want to do it at the current rates. But just the amount of activity, Nick nailed it. The amount of activity and purchasing, but also listing, is at really dramatic lows. I think he said lows that were on par with 2008. And everything in housing, and frankly, any financial market, happens at the margins, the marginal buyer and seller that sets the clearing price, right? And you know, with artificial, and I think the talk about what the home builders have done, home building stocks have been remarkably strong because it's been the only place, you know, to see action in real estate, really. And they've gone to some pretty extraordinary efforts to attract business, you know, lowering prices, I think 15% on average, which is, I think, as you already pointed out, where Nick sees almost as a proxy what the broad housing market would have to see in reductions to get in the game, so to speak. But also baiting with, you know, effectively buying down mortgages for new buyers. These are all things that speak to a housing market that is frozen and broken, but that invariably, either by choice or force, the fascinating data that he called out about the Airbnb situation. I have firsthand experience with people in my circle, and I've seen that, you know, rentals are down, activities down. When you do the math on buying a place with a certain pro forma cash flow coming in, even at low interest rates, suddenly looks like not a great investment. And I think like Nick anticipates, there'll be either by choice or by force some uptick in selling activity, probably later this year. I think he's calling for, you know, towards the end of this year, just a likely uptick. And one of the key things there, the drop in rents. Historically, rents and prices do eventually track each other. Right now they're dislocated. I think he said 2,500 a month, 2,700 to 2,800 a month, you know, effective all-in purchase costs right now, including mortgage, taxes, insurance, upkeep, and things like that, versus about 1,850 per month in rent. That chasm there still has to reconcile itself, and it's probably more likely that the housing costs will have to catch up downward towards where rents are, and as we've already talked about, and Nick pointed out, rents are in the decline. So it's a fascinating construct or creature that has been created, the triumvirate of bubbles, the real estate market, the stock market, and the bond market. The last decades has been engineered by artificially low interest rates, and I think we're in the early innings of that being reconciled.
All right, well, it's interesting, right? So bond market bubble has burst, right, with yields having gone up as high as they have. Housing market bubble looks like it's in the process of bursting. Stock market bubble looked like it was bursting. It's trying to reinflate right now. I guess TBD on what's going to happen there. I know you guys at New Harbor are putting more of your chips on the fact that it's going to fail to reinflate, and we'll have tougher times ahead, but we'll see what happens there. I'm curious on to the list of things that you just mentioned. you know, one of the things that's different this time that Nick and I talked about a bit was that institutional ownership is so much higher now than it's ever been before in the residential real estate market. And just like we're likely to see a bunch of selling of Airbnb units as everybody who piled in the past 2 years to get rich quick is now realizing they're getting poor quick, you know, as their listings are cash flow drains as opposed to cash flow gainers. How concerned are you about the vulnerability of that side of the market where you get a player that owns thousands of units, right? Maybe tens of thousands of units and just says, hey, you know what? Like we're losing an unacceptably large amount of money here. We just got to start chopping off limbs. And you just start seeing massive waves of inventory come on as they just say, I got to get rid of X, Y, or Z. I'm sure in the short term, they're going to try to sell to another institution. So none of those things actually kind of hit the market. But when you get to a point where nobody's really a buyer, if we get to that point and you got to still just start cutting off limbs to save yourself as an institutional investor, that could really disrupt the market. How worried are you about that?
It could be a big factor. You know, these are obviously shrewd institutional investors that are going to try not to take a bath on these. But at the end of the day, private investment vehicles follow flows, right? Many private equity groups are seeing more challenging fundraising environment. Cost of capital has gone up. You know, a lot of the companies and portfolios are levered, and therefore the profit margins have been trimmed.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't have the chart, but I did see a chart recently that, you know, in recent quarters, private equity capital calls have substantially exceeded private equity payouts.
Yeah, I think I shared that chart with in our weekly talk last week, Adam.
Maybe that was you, exactly. Okay, so, great.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, that creates a scarcity where private fund managers need to free up liquidity somehow, and they will sell across the board, not because they necessarily want to, but because they have to. And it might be that, hey, the getting's still good in real estate, but let's start picking a, you know, maybe private credit starts to gain more attention as yields blow out and we get some more credit distress as debt maturities start to come due. The private investment industry will pivot. They'll move capital to where the best opportunities are. And if it's selling real estate at a relatively still lofty height to go plow that money into dislocated private credit plays, absolutely, there'll be things like that happening. I think it's definitely a factor. These aren't buy and hold, you know, fall in love with houses kind of investors. It's like, you know, where's the best opportunity and where can we deploy for the next incremental best move? Maybe the play has already happened in housing. It probably already has, given what we just talked about with Nick there.
All right. And you know, just to show my cards a little bit here, you know, my worry both on the residential, on the regular seller side, the person actually lives in the house, but also in the investor side of things, there is a first mover advantage here, right? If you begin to really lose faith in the trajectory of the housing market, right now, sellers are really trying to just hang together in solidarity and say, all right, let's nobody sell. And hopefully we can just ride this thing out until mortgage rates come down. And then we kind of, you know, we're through the worst of it. But if people think that day is too far out in the future, it benefits the individual to bolt from the herd early and say, okay, look, I'll sell and I'll get 95% of the current market value, right? And I'm not going to be stuck chasing this down like the rest of you guys, right? So at some point, if there's no additional new reasons for optimism in the housing market, you're going to start seeing people bolt on the sell side, and that could be the trigger that really starts the next.
Absolutely, and the first mover thing is real. You know, Nick teased out some stats there. You know, it doesn't take much in terms of just an incremental increase in the amount of listings to completely overwhelm the inventory shortage that's often talked about, right? So
yeah, he said if we get just 500,000 new inventory, which is if I'm remembering, I think that's 0.5% of the current total housing stock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not much at all. And he said
doesn't take a lot.
All the inventory, you know, crunch that we've been hearing about.
Yeah, and then we see the natural forces of supply and demand, and that can change pretty quick. And
yeah, and he started interrupting him, but he had this like candidate set of these are the ones that could end up selling early, and that was over 30 million, right? Yeah. You only need 500,000 of that to disrupt everything.
Yeah, and a common thing we tell our clients, because ultimately it's got to get practical right back to clients' lives here for us. Those that are looking to sell and have the ability to be flexible to think about renting, we think it's a great time to think about that option. You and Nick teased that out as well. Especially right now when we're seeing rents soften. I mean, you could probably do some pretty good negotiating in rents right now into that trend. Average price decrease so far is only about 1% national decrease. Obviously, some areas have been in terms of house prices. Absolutely. We think it's a great time to think about selling a home, buying some time, renting, with the very likely scenario that you'd be able to purchase at a lower price and probably even at better financing costs. Because we do think ultimately, if recession takes hold and some of this moderation in inflation takes hold, you're going to see mortgage rates come down again. They got above 7%. We think they're probably not going back down below 3% anytime soon, but doesn't take a whole lot to make things a lot more affordable than right now on the purchase.
Yeah, and I wonder. I'm not going to ask you to predict this necessarily, but there is the chance that you could almost get the best of both worlds before this housing correction is fully played out, right? Where you get a material decrease in the cost of a house, and then at some point the Fed does reverse policy and drops interest rates, and you're basically able to lock in, a much better value of a house, and then eventually get a cheaper mortgage for it. And those things might not be coincident. You might have to buy at the lower value and then refinance when mortgage rates come down. But you could come out of this, if you play your cards right and are a little bit lucky, with getting the best of both worlds. And I just want to raise that, because right now, people have been getting a bad deal for so long in terms of affordability, but right now it's basically the worst ever. You get the worst of both worlds, right? You get prices near record highs and you get super expensive mortgage rates right now. The silver lining here is, there's a lot of people that might feel a lot of pain if the housing market does correct the way that Nick thinks it could, but that may open a time where you can get a much better value in a house.
Yep. And flexibility is key, to be able to exercise the option to act when you can. So if you have the ability to sell now or soon and rent and keep your options open for when that time comes, we think almost an unquantifiable value in terms of being able to play those scenarios.
Okay. Well, look, I know that as a financial advisor, you have a lot of clients, at all life stages, but many of them are later in life. They're wrestling with questions about when do I downsize? Or if I've got multiple properties, when does it make sense to sell them, whether to keep holding them or whatnot? It's unfair for me to ask you sort of for like a one size fits all bit of advice for these folks. But as a financial advisor, these are the type of questions that you help people think through, right? That they contact you and say, look, this is my personal situation around housing specifically. These are the decisions I'm wrestling with. Can you help give me some advice on this, taking into account kind of my entire financial situation, right? What are my goals? What am I trying to achieve here? What's my risk tolerance? What does the market look like? You're not exempt from saying this, but I just want people to understand that you can actually rely on a good financial advisor for a lot of other topics besides, hey, what like stock or bond should I be buying next?
Yeah, we work through and it is a very personalized discussion. It is hard to other than the broad dynamic that probably a pretty good time to be selling in most areas of the country, and probably good time if you have the flexibility to buy some time by renting, especially into a declining rent market that we're starting to see. But we get right down to the brass tacks with many of our clients. We'll look at modeling different scenarios for them and spreadsheets and just to kind of put it into what does it mean from a cash flow standpoint. We can absolutely do that. And we oftentimes do have those conversations. And there's always, when it comes to housing, there's always going to be a qualitative emotional aspect. At the end of the day, a house is a place to take refuge and create memories. It's, not a home in the sense that it's never more important than the people and the souls in the home. But it doesn't always have to be you know, optimal from an investment standpoint, but there still is plenty of room to make wise choices in terms of timing and decisions in that regard.
All right, great. Well, thanks so much, folks. If you are wrestling with decisions around real estate or just general decisions around the macro environment that John and I have been talking about here, again, always recommend you work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor to determine your path forward. If you've got a good one, who's building a personalized portfolio plan for you, taking into account all the macro issues that John and I talked about here, great. You're very fortunate. Stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion, maybe even from John and his team there at New Harbor Financial, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To do that, just go fill out the short form at wealthion.com. Only takes a couple of seconds. And again, these consultations, totally free, no commitment to work with the advisors. They're just offering it as a public service to help as many people as possible position prudently for what's coming ahead and for what their life goals are. Well, John, look, we're going to be taking next week off because I'm going to be back east going to my mother's memorial service and also visiting family actually out in your neck of the woods. There's a slight chance that we might be able to cross paths in person, which would be great if we can. A little anecdote story though. I'll be visiting my father who doesn't live too far from where you are in kind of a little sailing touristy town. And so we're staying in an Airbnb there. And I was kind of wincing as I went to book the Airbnb the other day, because I'm booking it like basically less than a week before I need it in the height of summer. And I just thought I was going to get raked across the coals. And I was really surprised at how affordable the pricing was. And the unit that we're renting is being rented by a super host, right? So they're the most popular people to rent from. And Airbnb does a thing where it says, okay, this unit usually goes for X price, and they draw a line through it and say, but right now it's going for, you know, this low price, you're getting a great deal. I mean, it was like hundreds and hundreds of dollars a night less than what it normally was during this time. So I just sort of took that as a kind of surprising early indicator that, wow, like the Airbnb market in this place has really softened. So anyways, data point one, can't draw too much from that, but I thought I'd share that with you. Look, I'll let you walk folks out here. What parting words of advice would you have for folks until we see them 2 weeks from now?
Well, I'd like to encourage folks to take a little bit of your lead, Adam, to take some time to unplug and get away from the day to day, hopefully a vacation or even just a time out. Adam, I hope for you, you have a proper celebration of your mom's life and safe travels and enjoyable travels. But, you know, the things will keep on moving here. We'll keep on doing our job. We'll miss recording a video with you next week, Adam. But, obviously you've got much higher priorities that deserve your attention. So,
well, that's very kind of you, John. Thanks. And just for viewers here, we're not going to leave you high and dry. I've been recording this week to bring you content next week. A lot of it's going to be surfacing some of the most important interviews that we've done on Wealthion over the past year that are just as timely, if not more so, given today's circumstances. So there will be content on this channel next week while I'll be traveling, folks. So don't feel like I'm leaving you in the lurch. And then I've got some great folks that we'll be releasing interviews with right as I get back, just to tease a couple. Lacey Hunt. We'll be doing another interview with Lacey Hunt for the public. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely. I've been talking about getting a behavioral economist on this channel for quarters now. Finally landed a big one. So that's going to be a fascinating discussion. And then Steph Pomboy has asked if she and Jim Rickards could come on and have a conversation kind of about everything. But one of the questions he's interested in hearing his thoughts about is this new BRICS, potential new BRICS currency that's being rumored that it's going to get announced officially next month. So stay tuned, folks. We've got some great material coming up ahead of here. All right, everyone. Thanks for sticking with John and I for this full video. If you appreciate these recaps with our financial advisors every week and everything else that we're doing on this channel, please help support us by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Always a pleasure, John. Hope I see you in person next week. If not, look forward to seeing you 2 weeks from now.
That'd be great, Adam. Safe travels, and we'll see you soon.
All right. Everyone else, thanks so much for watching.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free, and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to Wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.